not hard. You shouldered it bravely, knowing all the time that if you sent the signal, help would arrive. How wonderful to be part of such a club. Half a dozen men gathered around, engaged in the task, to save his marriage and his pride. So they did have hearts, after all. They were not cold, cruel dominators. They were not high school bullies to be avoided in the halls. They were good. They were kind. They came to the rescue. And today, Les was one of them. They reached the bottom of the bin. Nothing.
Oh, sorry, buddy, the bike guy said and grimaced.
The bearded man.
Tell her you lost it swimming.
One by one they shook his hand and shook their heads and left. Les wanted to cry. What a ridiculous person he was. What a terrible writer to get caught up in a metaphor like this. As if it would reveal anything to Robert, signify anything about their love. It was just a ring lost in a bin. But he could not help himself. He was too attracted to the bad poetry of it all, of his one good thing, his life with Robert, undone by his carelessness. There was no way to explain it that would not sound like betrayal. Everything would show in his voice. And Robert, the poet, would look up from his chair and see it, that their time had come to an end. Les leaned against the Vidalia onions and sighed. He took the bag, now empty of mushrooms, to crumple it up and toss it in the trash bin. A glint of gold. And there it was, in the bag all along. Oh, wonderful life! He laughed. He showed it to the shop owner. He bought all 5 pounds of mushrooms the men had handled and went home and made a soup with pork ribs and mustard greens and all the mushrooms and told Robert everything that had happened, from the ring to the men to the discovery, the great comedy of it all. And in the telling, laughing at himself, he watched as Robert looked up from his chair and saw everything. That's what it was like to live with genius. The subway ride back to the hotel is made half as charming by being filled with twice as many people, and the heat of the afternoon has made Les self-conscious that he smells of fish and peanuts. They pass the Farmacia Similares on the way to the hotel, and the head tells them he will catch up with them in a minute. They continue to the Monkey House, missing its minas, and though Les bows a quick goodbye, Arturo will not let him go. He insists that the American must taste mezcal, that it might change his writing or perhaps his life. There are some other writers waiting. Les keeps saying he has a headache, but nearby construction noise drowns him out and Arturo cannot understand. The head returns, beaming in the late afternoon light, a white bag in his hand. So Arthur Les goes along. Mezcal turns out to be a drink that tastes as if someone has put their cigarette out in it. You drink it, he is informed, with an orange slice that has been coated in toasted worms. You are kidding me, Les says, but they are not kidding him. Again, no one is kidding. They have 6 rounds. Les asks Arturo about his event at the festival, now a mere 2 days away. Arturo, his dour mood unchanged even after a bath of mezcal, says,
Yes, I am sorry to say tomorrow the festival is also entirely in Spanish. Shall I take you to Teotihuacan?
Les has no idea what this is, agrees, and asks again about his own event. Will he be on stage alone or in conversation?
I hope there will be conversation, Arturo states. You will be there with your friend.
Les asks if his fellow panelist is a professor or a fellow writer.
No, no. Friend, Arturo insists. You are speaking with Marion Brownburn.
Marion? His wife? She's here?
See? She arrives tomorrow night.
Les tries to assemble the wayward congress of his mind. Marion. The last words she ever said to him were, take care of my Robert. But she had not known then that he would take him from her. Robert kept Les away from the divorce, found the shack on the Vulcan steps, and he never met her again. Would she be 70? Finally given a stage to say what she thinks of Arthur Less?
Listen. You can't have us together. We haven't seen each other in almost 30 years.
Signor Banderbander thinks it's a nice surprise for you.
Less does not remember what he replies. All he knows is that he has been fooled into returning to Mexico, to the scene of the crime, to be impaneled before the world beside the woman he has wronged. Marion Brownburn with a microphone. Surely this is how gay men are judged in hell. By the time he returns to the hotel, he is drunk and stinks of smoke and worms. The next morning, Les is awakened at 6 as planned, introduced to a cup of coffee, and led into a black van with smoked windows. Arturo is there with two new friends who seem to speak no English. Les looks for the head to forestall disaster, but the head is nowhere in sight. All of this is in the pre-dawn darkness of Mexico City, with the sound of awakening birds and pushcarts. Arturo has also hired another guide, presumably at the festival's expense. A short, athletic man with gray hair and wire glasses. His name is Fernando, and he turns out to be a history professor at the university. He tries to engage Arthur in a discussion of the highlights of Mexico City and whether Les is interested in seeing them, perhaps after Teotihuacan, which has not yet been described. There are, for example, the twin houses of Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, surrounded by a fence of spineless cactus. Arthur Less nods, saying this morning he feels like a spineless cactus.
Sorry?
The guide asks. Yes, Less says, yes, he would like to see that.
I am afraid it is closed to mount a new exhibit.
And there is, as well, the house of the architect Luis Barragán, designed for a lifestyle of monkish mystery, where low ceilings lead to vaulted spaces, and Madonnas watch over the guest bed, and his private changing room is overseen by a Christ crucified without a cross. Les says that sounds lonely, but he would like to see that as well.
Yes, but it too is closed.
You are a terrible tease, Fernando, Les says, but the man does not seem to know what this means and goes on to describe the National Museum of Anthropology, the city's greatest museum, which can take days or even weeks to see completely, but with his guidance, can be done in a number of hours. By this point, the van has clearly taken them out of Mexico City proper, the parks and mansions replaced by concrete shanty towns painted all in taffy colors that Les knows belie their misery. A sign points to Teotihuacan y Pirámides. The Museum of Anthropology, Fernando insists, is not to be missed. But it is closed, Les offers.
On Mondays, I am sorry, yes.
As the van rounds the corner of an agave grove, he is aware of an enormous structure with the sun pulsing behind it and striping it in shadows of green and indigo. The Temple of the Sun.
It is not the Temple of the Sun, Fernando informs him. That is what the Aztecs thought it was. It is most probably the Temple of the Rain, but we know almost nothing about the people who built it. The site was long abandoned by the time the Aztecs came through. We believe they burned their own city to the ground.
A cold blue silhouette of a long-lost civilization. They spend the morning climbing the two massive pyramids, the Temple of the Sun and the Temple of the Moon, walking the Avenue of the Dead.
It is not the Avenue of the Dead, really, Fernando informs him, and it is not the Temple of the Moon.
Imagining all of it covered in painted stucco, miles and miles, every wall and floor and roof in the ancient city that once held hundreds of thousands of people about whom literally nothing is known, not even their names. Les imagines a priest covered in peacock feathers walking down the steps as in an MGM musical or a drag show, arms spread wide as music plays from conch shells all around, and Marion Brownburn, standing at the top, holds the beating heart of Arthur Less.
They chose this spot, we think, because it was far from the volcano that destroyed villages in ancient times. That volcano there,
Fernando said, pointing to a peak barely visible in the morning haze. Is it still active, that volcano?
No, Fernando says sadly, shaking his head. It is closed.
What was it like to live with genius?
Like living alone.
Like living alone with a tiger. Everything had to be sacrificed for the work. Plans had to be canceled. Meals had to be delayed. Liquor had to be bought as soon as possible, or else all poured into the sink. Money had to be rationed or spent lavishly, changing daily. The sleep schedule was the poet's to make, and it was as often late nights as it was early mornings. The habit was the demon pet in the house. The habit, the habit, the habit. The morning coffee and books and poetry, the silence until noon. Could he be tempted by a morning stroll? He could. He always could. It was the only addiction where the sufferer longed for anything but the desired. But a morning walk meant work undone. And suffering, suffering, suffering. Keep the habit. Help the habit. Lay out the coffee and poetry. Keep the silence. Smile when he walked sulkily out of his office to the bathroom. Taking nothing personally. And did you sometimes leave an art book around with a thought that it would be the key to his mind? And did you sometimes put on music that might unlock the doubt and fear? Did you love it, the rain dance, every day? Only when it rained. Where did the genius come from? Where did it go? Like allowing another lover into the house to live with you, someone you'd never met but whom you knew he loved more than you. Poetry every day. A novel every few years. Something happened in that room despite everything. Something beautiful happened. It was the only place in the world where time made things better. Life with doubt. Doubt in the morning, with the oil beating on a cup of coffee. Doubt in the pee break, not catching his eye. Doubt in the sound of the front door opening and closing, a restless walk, no goodbye, and in the return. Doubt in the slow sound of typewriter keys. Doubt at lunchtime, taken in his room. Doubt vanishing in the afternoon like the fog. Doubt driven away. Doubt forgotten. 4 in the morning, feeling him stirring awake, knowing he is staring at the darkness. At doubt. Life with doubt. A memoir. What made it happen? What made it not happen? Thinking of a cure, a week away from the city, a dinner party with other geniuses, a new rug, a new shirt, a new way to hold him in bed, and failing and failing and somehow at random, succeeding. Was it worth it? Luck in days of endless golden words. Luck in checks in the mail. Luck in prize ceremonies and trips to Rome and London. Luck in tuxedos and hands secretly held beside the mayor or the governor or, one time, the president. Peeking in the room while he was out, rooting through the trash bin. Looking at the blanket heaped on the napping couch, the books beside it. And, with dread, what sat half-written in the typewriter's gap-toothed mouth. For at the beginning, one never knew what he was writing about. Was it you? Before a mirror, behind him, tying his tie for a reading while he smiles, for he knows perfectly well how to tie it. Marion, was it worth it for you? The festival takes place in University City in a low-ceilinged concrete building associated with the Global Linguistics and Literature Department, whose famous mosaics have for some reason been removed for restoration, leaving it as barren as an old woman without her teeth. Again, the head does not make an appearance. Les's day of judgment has arrived. He finds he is shaking with fear. Color-coded carpets lead to various sub-departments, and around any corner, Marion Brownburn might appear, tanned and sinewy, as he remembers her on a beach. But when Les is led to a green room, painted a pastel green supplied with a tower of fruit, he is introduced only to a friendly man in a harlequin tie. "Signor Les," the man says, bowing twice. "What an honor for you to come to the festival." Les looks around for his personal fury. There is no one in the room but him, this man, and Arturo.
Is Marianne Brownburn here?
The man bows.
I am sorry it was so much in Spanish.
Les hears his name shouted from the doorway and flinches. It is the head, his curly white hair in disarray, his face a grotesque shade of red. He motions Les over. Les quickly approaches.
Sorry I missed you yesterday, says the head. I had other business, but I wouldn't miss this panel for the world.
Is Marianne here?
Les asks quietly.
You'll be fine, don't worry.
I'd just like to see her before we-
She isn't coming.
The head puts his heavy hand on Les's shoulder.
We got a note last night. She broke her hip. She's nearly 80, you know. A shame, because we had so many questions for you both.
Les experiences not a helium-filled sense of relief, but a horrible deflating sorrow.
Is she okay?
She sends her love to you.
But is she okay?
Sure. We had to make a new plan. I'm going to be up there with you. I'll talk for maybe 20 minutes about my work, then I'll ask you about meeting Brownburn when you were 21. Do I have that right? You were 21?
I'm 25, Les lies to the woman on the beach. Young Arthur Les, sitting on a beach towel, perched with three other men above the high tide line. It is San Francisco in October 1987. It is 75 degrees, and everyone is celebrating like children with a snow day. No one goes to work. Everyone harvests their pot plants. Sunlight flows as sweet and yellow as the cheap champagne sitting half-finished and now too warm in the sand beside young Arthur Les. The anomaly causing the hot weather is also responsible for extraordinarily high waves that send men scrambling from the rockier gay section over to the straight section of Baker Beach, and there they all huddled together, united in the dunes. Before them, the ocean wrestles with itself in silver blue. Arthur Les is a little drunk and a little high. He is naked. He is 21. The woman beside him, tanned to alderwood, topless, has begun to talk to him. She wears sunglasses. She is smoking. She is somewhere past 40. She says, "Well, I hope you're making good use of youth." Les, cross-legged on his towel and pink as a boiled shrimp, "I don't know." She nods. "You should waste it." "What's that?" "You should be at the beach like today. You should get stoned and drunk and have loads of sex." She takes another drag off her cigarette. "I think the saddest thing in the world is a 25-year-old talking about the stock market. Or taxes. Or real estate. God damn it. That's all you'll talk about when you're 40. Real estate. Any 25-year-old who says the word refinance should be taken out and shot. Talk about love and music and poetry, things everyone forgets they ever thought were important. Waste every day. That's what I say." He laughs goofily and looks over at his group of friends. "I guess I'm doing pretty good at that. You queer, honey?" "Oh," he says, smiling. "Yeah." The man beside him, a broad-chested Italianate fellow in his 30s, asks for young Arthur Les to do my back. The lady seems amused, and Les turns to apply cream to the man's back, the color of which reveals it is far too late. Dutifully, he does his job anyway and receives a pat on the rump. Les takes a swig of warm champagne. The waves are growing in intensity. People leap in there, laughing, screaming with delight. Arthur Les at 21. Thin and boyish, not a muscle on him, his blonde hair bleached white, his toes painted red. Sitting on a beach on a beautiful day in San Francisco in the awful year of 1987, and terrified, terrified, terrified. AIDS is unstoppable. When he turns, the lady is still staring at him and smoking. "Is that your guy?" she asks. He looks over at the Italian, then turns back and nods. "And the handsome man beyond him?" My friend Carlos.
Naked, muscled, and browned by the sun like a polished redwood burl. Young Carlos lifting his head from the towel as he hears his name.
You boys are all so beautiful. Lucky man to have snatched you up. I hope he fucks you silly.
She laughs.
Mine used to.
I don't know about that, Les says softly so that the Italian will not hear.
Maybe what you need at your age is a broken heart.
He laughs and runs a hand through his bleached hair.
I don't know about that either. Ever had one?
No, he shouts, still laughing, bringing his knees up to his chest. A man stands up from behind the woman. Her pose has hidden him all this time. The lean body of a runner, sunglasses, a Rock Hudson jaw. Also naked. He looks down first at her, then at young Arthur Less, then says aloud to everybody that he is going in.
You're an idiot, the lady says, sitting straight up. It's a hurricane out there.
He says he has swum in hurricanes before. He has a faint British accent, or perhaps he's from New England. The lady turns to Les and lowers her sunglasses. Her eyeshadow is hummingbird blue.
Young man, my name's Marion. Will you do me a favor? Go in the water with my ridiculous husband. He may be a great poet, but he's a terrible swimmer, and I can't bear to watch him die. Will you go with him?
Young Arthur Less nods yes and stands up with the smile he saves for grown-ups. The man nods in greeting. Marion Brownburn grabs a large black straw hat, puts it on her head, and waves to them.
Go on, boys. Take care of my Robert.
The sky takes on a shimmer as blue as her eyeshadow, and as the men approach the waves, they seem to redouble in violence like a fire that has been fed a bundle of kindling. Together they stand in the sun before those terrible waves, in the fall of that terrible year. By spring, they will be living together on the Vulcan steps.
We had to do a quick change to the program. You can see it has a new title.
But Les, conversant only in German, can make nothing of the words on the paper he has just been handed. People are coming and going now, clipping a microphone to his lapel, offering him water. But Arthur Les is still halfway lit by beach sunshine, halfway in the water of the Golden Gate in 1987.
Take care of my Robert.
And now an old woman, falling and breaking her hip. She sends her love. No rancor. No feelings at all. The head leans forward with a whisper and a comradely wink.
By the way, wanted you to know, those pills work great.
Les looks over at the man. Is it the pills that make him so flushed and grotesque? What else do they sell here for middle-aged men? Is there a pill for when the image of a trumpet vine comes into your head? Will it erase it? Erase the voice saying, you should kiss me like it's goodbye. Erase the tuxedo jacket, or at least the face above it. Erase the whole 9 years. Robert would say,
the work will fix you.
The work, the habit, the words will fix you. Nothing else can be depended on, and Les has known genius, what genius can do. But what if you are not a genius? What will the work do then?
What's the new title?
Les asks. The head passes the program to Arturo. Les consoles himself that tomorrow he will board a plane to Italy. The language is getting to him. The lingering taste of mezcal is getting to him. The tragicomic business of being alive is getting to him. Arturo studies the program for a moment, then looks up gravely.
Una noche con Arthur Les.
Les, Italian. Along with the other drugs Arthur Les bought at Mexico City's airport pharmacia, Les has obtained a new variety of sleeping pill. He recalls Freddie's advice from years before. It's a hypnotic instead of a narcotic. They serve you dinner, you sleep 7 hours, they serve you breakfast, you're there. Thus armed, Les boards the Lufthansa aircraft. He will have a fairly rushed layover in Frankfurt, settles into his window seat,
chooses the Tuscan chicken, whose ravishing name reveals itself, like an internet lover, to be mere chicken and mashed potatoes, and with his Thumbelina bottle of red wine takes a single white capsule. His remaining anxiety from Un Noche con Arthur Less is working against his exhaustion. The sound of the head's amplified voice loops in his brain, saying again and again, "We were talking backstage about mediocrity." He hopes the drug will do its duty. It does. He does not remember finishing the Bavarian cream in its little egg cup, nor the removal of his dinner, nor setting his watch to a new time zone, nor a dozing talk with his seatmate, a girl from Jalisco. Instead, Les awakens to a plain of sleeping citizens under blue prison blankets. Dreamily happy, he looks at his watch and panics. Only 2 hours have passed. There are still 9 more to go. On the monitors, a recent American cop comedy plays soundlessly. As with any silent movie, it needs no sound for him to imagine its plot. A heist by amateurs. He tries to fall back asleep, his jacket as a pillow. His mind plays a movie of his present life. A heist by amateurs. Les takes a deep breath and fumbles in his bag. He finds another pill and puts it in his mouth. An endless process of dry swallowing he remembers from being a boy with his vitamins. Then it is done, and he places the thin satin mask again over his eyes, ready to re-enter the darkness.
"Sir, your breakfast, a coffee or tea?"
"What? Coffee." Shades are being opened to let in the bright sun above the heavy clouds. Blankets are being put away. Has any time passed? He does not remember sleeping. He looks at his watch. What madman has set it? To what time zone? Singapore? Breakfast. They are about to descend into Frankfurt, and he has just taken a hypnotic. A tray is placed before him, a microwave croissant with frozen butter and jam, a cup of coffee. Well, he will have to push through. Perhaps the coffee will counteract the sedative. You take an upper for a downer, right? This, Les thinks to himself as he tries to butter the bread with its companion chunk of ice, is how drug addicts think. He's going to Turin for a prize ceremony, and in the days leading into the ceremony there will be interviews, something called a confrontation with high school students, and many luncheons and dinners. He looks forward to escaping briefly into the streets of Turin, a town unknown to him. Contained deep within the invitation was the information that the greater prize has already been awarded to the famous British author Foster's Lancet, son of the famous British author Reginald Lancet. He wonders if the poor man is actually coming. Because of his fear of jet lag, Les requested to arrive a day before all these events, and for some reason they acceded to his request. A car, he has been told, will be waiting for him in Turin, if he manages to make it there. He floats through the Frankfurt airport in a dream, thinking, "Passport, wallet, phone. Passport, wallet, phone." On a great blue screen, he finds his flight to Turin has changed terminals. Why, he wonders, are there no clocks in airports? He passes through miles of leather handbags and perfumes and whiskies, miles of beautiful Turkish retail maids, and in this dream he is talking to them about colognes and letting them giggle and spritz him with scents of leather and musk. He is looking through wallets and fingering the ostrich leather as if some message were written in Braille. He imagines standing at the counter of a VIP lounge and talking to the receptionist, a lady with sea urchin hair, about his childhood in Delaware, charming his way into the lounge where businessmen of all nationalities are wearing the same suit, and he sits in a cream leather chair, drinks champagne, eats oysters, and there the dream fades. He awakens in a bus, headed somewhere. But where? Why is he holding so many bags? Why is there the tickle of champagne in his throat? Les tries to listen among the strap hangers for Italian. He must find the flight to Turin. Around him seemed to be only American businessmen talking about sports. Les recognizes the words, but not the names. He feels un-American. He feels homosexual. Les notes there are at least 5 men on the bus taller than he, which seems like a life record. His mind, a sloth making its slow way across the forest floor of necessity, is taking in the fact that he is still in Germany. Les is due to be back in Germany in just a week's time to teach a 5-week course at the liberated university. And it is while he is in Germany that the wedding will take place. Freddie will marry Tom somewhere in Sonoma. The shuttle crosses the tarmac and deposits them at an identical terminal. Nightmarishly, passport control. Yes, he still has his in his front left pocket.
Geschäftlich.
He answers the muscular agent, red hair cut so close it seems painted on, secretly thinking, what I do is hardly business. Or pleasure. Security again. Shoes, belt, off, again. What is the logic here? Passport, customs, security, again? Why do today's young men insist on marrying? Was this why we all threw stones at the police for weddings? Submitting to his bladder at last, Les enters a white-tiled bathroom and sees, in the mirror, an old, balding uncle in wrinkled, oversized clothes. It turns out there is no mirror. It is the businessman across the sink. A Marx Brothers joke. Les washes his own face, not the businessman's, finds his gate, and boards the plane. Passport, wallet, phone. He sinks into his window seat with a sigh and never gets his second breakfast. He has fallen instantly to sleep. Les awakens to a feeling of peace and triumph.
Stiamo iniziando la discesa verso Torino. We are beginning our descent into Turin.
His seatmate seems to have moved across the aisle. He removes his eye mask and smiles at the Alps below. An optical illusion making them into craters and not mountains, and then he sees the city itself. They land serenely, and a woman in the back applauds. He is reminded of landing in Mexico. He recalls smoking on an airplane once when he was young, checks his armrest, finds an ashtray in it still. Charming or alarming? A chime rings. Passengers stand up. Passport, wallet, phone. Les has manned his way through the crisis. He no longer feels mickeyed or dull. His bag is the first to arrive on the luggage roller coaster. A dog, eager to greet its master. No passport control, just an exit. And here, wonderfully, a young man in an old man's mustache holding a sign lettered SR.ESS. Les raises his hand, and the man takes his luggage. Inside the sleek black car, Les finds his driver speaks no English. Fantastico, he thinks, as he closes his eyes again. Has he been to Italy before? He has, twice. Once when he was 12 on a family trip that took the path of a pachinko game by beginning in Rome, shooting up to London, and falling back and forth among various countries until they landed, at last, in Italy's slot. Of Rome, all he remembers, in his childish exhaustion, are the stone buildings stained as if hauled from the ocean, the heart-stopping traffic, his father lugging old-fashioned suitcases, including his mother's mysterious makeup kit, across the cobblestones, and the nighttime click, click, click of the yellow window shade as it flirted with the Roman wind. His mother, in her final years, often tried to coax other memories from Les, sitting bedside.
Don't you remember the landlady with the wig that kept falling off? The handsome waiter who offered to drive us to his mother's house for lasagna? The man at the Vatican who wanted to charge you for an adult ticket because you were so tall?
There, with her head wrapped in a scarf with white seashells. Yes, he said every time, just as he always did with his agent, pretending to read books he had never even heard of. The wig. Lasagna. The Vatican. The second time he went with Robert. It was in the middle of their time together when Les was finally worldly enough to be of help with travel, and Robert had not become so filled with bitterness that he was a hindrance. The time when any couple has found its balance, and passion has quieted from its early scream, but gratitude is still abundant. What no one realizes are the golden years. Robert was in a rare mood for travel, and had accepted an invitation to read at a literary festival in Rome. Rome was itself enough, but showing Rome to Les was like having the chance to introduce someone to a beloved aunt. Whatever happened would be memorable. What they did not realize until they arrived was that the event was to take place in the ancient Forum, where thousands would gather in the summer wind to listen to a poet read before a crumbling arch. He would be standing on a dais lit by pink spotlights, with an orchestra playing Philip Glass between each poem.
"I will never read anywhere like this again," Robert whispered to Les, standing backstage as a brief biographical clip played for the audience on an enormous screen. Robert as a boy in a cowboy costume, as a serious Harvard student with his pal Ross. Then he and Ross in a San Francisco cafe, a woodland setting. Picking up more and more artistic companions until Robert reached the face recognizable from his Newsweek photograph. Hair gone gray and wild, retaining that monkey business expression of a capering mind. He would not frown for a photo. The music swelled. His name was called. 4,000 people applauded, and Robert, in his gray silk suit, readied himself to stride onto a pink-lit stage below the ruins of the centuries and let go of his lover's hand like someone falling from a cliff. Les opens his eyes to a countryside of autumn vineyards, endless rows of the crucified plants, a pink rosebush always planted at the end. He wonders why. The hills roll to the horizon, and atop each hill, a little town silhouetted with its single church spire and no visible way of approach except with rope and a pick. Les senses by the sun's shift that at least an hour has passed. He is not headed to Turin, then. He is being taken somewhere else. Switzerland? Les understands at last what is happening. He is in the wrong car. SR period ESS. He anagrams in his mind what he took in his lingering hypnosis and pride for Signor and a childlike misspelling of Les. Sriramathan S? Strovinka Eskaterinovich? SRESS? Società de la Repubblica Europa per la Sexualité Studentesca? Almost anything makes sense to Les at this altitude. But it is obvious. Having cleared the problems of travel, he let his guard slip, waved at the first sign resembling his name, and was whisked away to an unknown location. He knows life's commedia dell'arte and how he has been cast. He sighs in his seat, staring out at a shrine to an auto accident placed at a particularly rough curve in the road. He feels the Madonna's plastic eyes meet his for an instant. And now the signs for a particular town become more frequent, and a particular hotel. Something called Mondolce Golf Resort. Les stiffens in fear. His narrating mind whittles the possibilities down. He had taken the car of a Dr. Ludwig S., some vacationing Austrian doctor who is off to a golf resort in Piemonte with his wife. He, brown-skulled with white hair and puffs over his ears, little steel glasses, red shorts and suspenders. Frau S? Short, blonde hair with a streak of pink, rough linen tunics and chili pepper leggings. Walking sticks packed in their luggage for jaunts to the village. She has signed up for courses in Italian cooking while he dreams of 9 holes and 9 Morettis. And now they stand in some hotel lobby in Turin, shouting with the proprietor while a bellboy waits holding the elevator. Why did Les come a day early? There will be no one from the Prize Foundation to straighten out the misunderstanding.
The poor S voices will echo emptily up to the lobby chandelier. Benvenuto, a sign reads as they pull into a drive. A Mondolce golf resort. A glass box on a hill. A pool. Golf holes all around.
Ecco, the driver announces as they pull to the front.
The last sunlight flashes on the pool. Two beautiful young women emerge from the entryway's hall of mirrors, hands clasped. Les readies himself for full mortification. But life has pardoned him at the scaffold steps.
Welcome, says the tall one in the seahorse print dress, to Italy and to your hotel. Mr. Les, we are greet you from the prize committee.
The other finalists do not arrive until late the following day, so Les has almost 24 hours in the golf resort by himself. Like a curious child, he tries the pool, then the sauna, the cold plunge, the steam room, the cold plunge again, until he is as scarlet as a fever victim. Unable to decipher the menu at the restaurant, where he dines alone in a shimmering greenhouse, for three meals he orders something he recalls from a novel. Steak tartare of the local Fasona. For three meals, he orders the same Nebbiolo. He sits in the glass sunlit room like the last human on Earth, with a wine cellar to last him a lifetime. There is an amphora of petunia-like flowers on his private deck, worried day and night by little bees. On closer inspection, Les sees that instead of stingers, they have long noses to probe the purple flowers with. Not bees. Pygmy hummingbird moths. The discovery delights him to his core. Les's pleasures are tinted only slightly the following afternoon when a mixed group of teenagers appears at the edge of the pool and stares as he does his laps. He returns to his room, all Swedish whitened wood, with a steel fireplace hanging on the wall.
There is wood in the room, the seahorse lady said. You know how to light a fire, yes?
Les nods. He used to go camping with his father. He stacks the wood in a little Cub Scout teepee and stuffs the underspace with Corriere della Sera and lights the thing. Time for his rubber bands. Les has, for years, traveled with a set of rubber bands that he thinks of as his portable gym. The set is multicolored with interchangeable handles, and he always imagines, when he coils them into his luggage, how toned and fit he will be when he returns. The ambitious routine begins in earnest the first night, with dozens of special techniques recommended in the manual, lost long ago in Los Angeles, but remembered in parts. Les wrapping the bands around the legs of beds, columns, rafters, and performing what the manual called lumberjacks, trophies, and action heroes. He ends his workout lacquered in sweat, feeling he has beat back another day from time's assault. 50 is further than ever. The second night, he advises himself to let his muscles repair. The third, he remembers the set and begins the routine with half a heart. The thin walls of the room might tremble with the neighbor's television, or the dead bathroom light might depress him, or the thought of an unfinished article. Les promises himself a better workout in 2 days. In return for this promise, a dollhouse whiskey from the room's dollhouse bar. And then the set is forgotten, abandoned on the hotel's side table, a slain dragon. Les is no athlete. His single moment of greatness came one spring afternoon when he was 12. In the suburbs of Delaware, spring meant not young love and damp flowers, but an ugly divorce from winter and a second marriage to buxom summer. August's steam room setting came on automatically in May. Cherry and plum blossoms made the slightest wind into a ticker tape parade, and the air filled with pollen. School teachers heard the boys giggling at the sweat shine on their bosoms. Young roller skaters found themselves stuck in softening asphalt. It was the year the cicadas returned. Les had not been alive when they buried themselves in the earth. But now they returned, tens of thousands of them, horrifying but harmless, drunk driving through the air so they bumped into heads and ears, encrusting telephone poles and parked cars with their delicate, amber-hued, almost Egyptian discarded shells. Girls wore them as earrings. Boys, Tom Sawyer descendants, trapped the live ones in paper bags and released them at study hour. At night, the creatures hummed in huge choruses, the sound pulsing around the neighborhood. And school would not end until June, if ever. Then, picture young Les, 12 years old, his first year wearing the gold-rimmed glasses that would return to him 30 years later when a shopkeeper recommended a pair in Paris, and a thrill of sad recognition and shame would course through his body. The short boy in glasses in right field, his hair as gold-white as old ivory, covered now by a black-yellow baseball cap, wandering in the clover with a dreamy look in his eyes. Nothing has happened in right field all season, which is why he was put there, a kind of athletic Canada. His father, though Les would not know this for over a decade, had had to attend a meeting of the Public Athletics Board to defend his son's right to participate in the league, despite his clear lack of talent at baseball and obliviousness on the field. His father actually had to remind his son's coach, who had recommended Les's removal, that it was a public athletic league and, like a public library, was open to all, even the fumbling oafs among us. And his mother, a softball champ in her day, has had to pretend none of this matters to her at all, and drives Les to games with a speech about sportsmanship that is more a dismantling of her own beliefs than a relief to the boy. Picture Les with his leather glove weighing down his left hand, sweating in the spring heat, his mind lost in the reverie of his childhood lunacies before they give way to adolescent lunacies, when an object appears in the sky. Acting almost on a species memory, he runs forward, the glove before him. The bright sun spangles his vision, and thwack! The crowd is screaming. He looks into the glove and sees, gloriously grass-bruised and double-stitched in red, the single catch of his lifespan. From the stands, his mother's ecstatic cry. From his bag in Piemonte, the famous rubber bands uncoiled for the famous childhood hero. From the cabin's doorway, the seahorse lady bursting in, opening windows to let out the smoke from Les's botched attempt at a fire. Arthur Les was up for a prize only once before, something called the Wild and Stein Literary Laurels. He was informed of the mysterious honor through his agent, Peter Hunt. Les, perhaps hearing Wildenstein, replied he wasn't Jewish. Peter coughed and said, "I believe it is something gay." It was, and yet Les was surprised. He had spent half a lifetime living with a writer whose sexuality was never mentioned, much less his half-life as a married man. To be called a gay writer. Robert scorned the idea. It was like elevating the importance of his childhood in Westchester, Connecticut. "I don't write about Westchester," he would say. "I don't think about Westchester. I'm not a Westchester poet." Which would have surprised Westchester, whose council had placed a plaque on the middle school Robert had attended. Gay, black, Jewish. Robert and his friends thought they were beyond all that. So Les was surprised to know this kind of award even existed. His first response to Peter was to ask, "How did they even know I was gay?" He asked this from his front porch wearing a kimono, but Peter persuaded him to attend. Les and Robert had split by then, and anxious about how he would appear to this mysterious gay literary world and desperate for a date, he panicked and asked Freddie Pelu. Who knew Freddie, then only 26, would be such a boon? They arrived to a college auditorium, banners everywhere, "Hopes are the ladders to dreams," on whose stage 6 wooden chairs were arranged as in a court of law. Les and Freddie took their seats. "Wild and Stein," Freddie said. "It sounds like a vaudeville act." Around them, people were shouting recognition and hugging and having intense conversations. Les recognized none of them. It seemed so strange. Here, his contemporaries, his peers, and they were strangers. But not to bookish Freddy, suddenly come alive in literary company.
Look, there's Meredith Castle. She's a language poet, Arthur, you should know her. And that one is Harold Fricks.
And so on. Freddy, peering through his red glasses at these oddities and naming each with satisfaction. It was like being with a bird watcher. The lights went down, and six men and women walked on stage, some of them so elderly they seemed to be automatons, and sat in the chairs. One small, bald man in tinted glasses stepped to the microphone.
"That's Finley Dwyer,"
Freddy whispered. Whoever that was. The man began to welcome them all, and then his face brightened.
"I admit I will be disappointed tonight if we reward the assimilationists, the ones who write the way straight people write, who hold up heterosexuals as war heroes, who make gay characters suffer, who set their characters adrift in a nostalgic past that ignores our present oppression. I say we purge ourselves of these people, who would have us vanish into the bookstore, the assimilationists who are, at their core, ashamed of who they are, who we are, who you are."
The audience applauded wildly. War heroes, suffering characters, adrift in a nostalgic past. Les recognized these elements as a mother might recognize the police description of a serial killer. It was Calypso. Finley Dwyer was talking about him. Him, harmless little Arthur Les, the enemy. The audience roared on, and Les turned and whispered shakily,
"Freddy, I have to get out of here."
Freddy looked at him with surprise. "Hopes are the ladders to dreams, Arthur." But then he saw Les was serious. When the award for Book of the Year came up, Les did not hear the announcement. He was lying on his bed, while Freddy was saying not to worry. Their lovemaking had been ruined by the bedroom bookcase, from which dead writers stared at him like dogs at the foot of the bed. Perhaps Les was ashamed, as Finley Dwyer had accused. A bird outside the window seemed to be mocking him. He had not, in any case, won. Les has read, in the packet the beautiful women handed him before vanishing into the glasswork, that while the five finalists were chosen by an elderly committee, the final jury is made up of 12 high school students. The second night, they appear in the lobby dressed up in elegant flowered dresses, the girls, or their dad's oversized blazers, the boys. Why did it not occur to Les these were the same teens by the pool? The teens move like a tour group into the greenhouse, formerly Les's private dining room, which now bustles with caterers and unknown people. The beautiful Italian women reappear and introduce him to his fellow finalists. Les feels his confidence drop. The first is Riccardo, a young, unshaven Italian man, incredibly tall and thin, in sunglasses, jeans, and a t-shirt that reveals the Japanese carp tattoos on both arms. The other three are all much older. Luisa, glamorously white-haired and dressed in a white cotton tunic, with gold alien bracelets for fending off critics. Alessandro, a cartoon villain with streaks of white at his temples, a pencil mustache, and black plastic spectacles that narrow his look of disapproval. And a short rose-gold gnome from Finland who asks to be called Harry, though his name on the books is something else entirely. Their works, Les is told, are a Sicilian historical novel, a retelling of Rapunzel in modern-day Russia, an 800-page novel of a man's last minute on his deathbed in Paris, and an imagined life of Saint Marjorie. Les cannot seem to match each novel with its author. Has the young one made the deathbed novel or Rapunzel? Either seems likely. They are all so intellectual. Les knows at once he hasn't a chance.
"I read your book," says Luisa, her left eye batting away a loose scrap of mascara while her right one stares straight into his heart. "It took me to new places. I thought of Joyce in outer space,
The Finn seems to be brimming with mirth. The cartoon villain adds, "He would not live long, I think."
"Portrait of the artist as a spaceman,"
the Finn says at last, and covers his teeth as he ticks away with silent laughter.
"I have not read it, but..."